Hello again. This is Eat to the Beat. I'm Sarah Obritis. We're on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. And physically, we are in a makeshift radio station that is much more professional than makeshift. But nonetheless, our sponsor happens to be Roberta's Pizzeria, where we are housed behind in Bushwick, Brooklyn, New York. Eat to the Beat is a show about the crisscrossing worlds of food and music and art of all genres. And today we have the coolest couple in Cali. They epitomize food and music. And that is Gordon Smith and Reparata Mazzola. Hey, guys.
Hi there.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, calling in from Southern California. Gordon is a third-generation native of Southern California. We'll discuss a little bit about the agricultural history of the region, then his road to becoming a chef for, of all people, Betty Ford. And we'll talk about slow food. Gordon was and is the governor of Slow Food Southern California. Reparata was the singer for Reparata and the Delrons, which had top 10 hits in the 60s. And I just heard her on the radio this weekend, actually. She's also a professional poker player.
Well, I'm not professional. I write for poker.
You write for poker, but you could be professional and you could be rich
by
now. And Rep also has a book called Mafia Kingpin, the true story of Sonny Gibson. And she's also going to tell us about a nonprofit that she helps run. So thanks for calling in from Southern California. Now, Gordon, you come from third generation. You come from a town called Covina. I don't know if you'd call it a town or a district or a huge metropolis, but
it was just a small city outside of L.A. When I grew up there in the 50s, it was basically all orange groves and small farms, and it was an area that I'd have to say I was kind of part of the beaver cleaver generation.
Mm-hmm. That was back when it took like an hour to get to Los Angeles, right?
Yeah. When we first moved there, it was there wasn't even a freeway coming into the area. You had to get on Highway 66, Route 66. To get to Covina.
Nice.
But a few years later, then there was the big Highway 10 or Freeway 10 that got you to L.A. But when my grandfather was here, he would tell us stories of out in the area of Cucamonga, which is near Ontario, and he would take a buckboard and come into L.A., and it was a three-day trip. So.
Well, before the days of what Joan Didion wrote about, didn't she used to write about that region in San Bernardino? And anyway, she seemed to be a writer that covered that Southern California.
Yeah, she did a lot of articles about the area. She was one of the very hip journalists. That is I don't know what she's writing these days. I haven't seen too much of her.
She's writing about growing up and growing old.
No, it was a fun time. Our doors were all unlocked. We all played in the orchards. We all kind of just had a pretty careful, free life. There wasn't a lot of crime. There wasn't, TV was just coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I remember having one of those little small TVs that had the little tiny little monitors and but you know, most of the time it was just playing with your friends, and you don't ever see anybody anymore out there in the schoolyards playing baseball and football, and kind of a strange new world we live in.
Yeah, totally. Well, and TV helped shape your world back then, didn't it? I mean,
definitely. Oh, sure.
You mentioned running back and forth to the TV, watching the galloping gourmet and
well,
Julia
when
Childs.
I got older, I did. There was a time I was four boys in our family, and my mother, you know, was a housewife, and she would watch the Galloping Gourmet. And for some reason, I just kind of enjoyed that show. I guess part of it, I mean, it was quite entertaining. The guy was half drunk most of the time anyway, so which I didn't realize at the time. But the guy definitely was a big, you know, he was just always happy and fun, and it turned out that he was really enjoying life while he was on the camera.
Right. I think they had him, someone or something forced him to come out with a book that was about, he used so much butter and so much salt, you know, so much liquor, if you will, you know, so many things that ultimately people found were, you know, supposed to make you, you know, die early, make you sick, that kind of crap. And so he succumbed and I think came out with, like, How to Live More Healthily by the Galloping Gourmet.
Yeah, well, he went into rehab is what he did, and then he found Christ, and he went into that kind of a thing, and then he went back on, and he did a health food show or something like that eventually. But in his early days, he was, you know, in those days, what was live TV, and it was a very interesting time doing TV in Los Angeles, and we just lost one of our favorite TV show hosts that is now gone. It was Soupy Sales that we used to watch, and, you know, I mean, it was a humor I think I would find quite more. I mean, it was just as funny when you were a kid, and it was funny when you're an adult. Soupy was awesome.
Exactly. So. You wonder who from this generation, both on TV and in rock and roll or music or any sort of artistic community, who are we going to miss when they pass away in 50 years?
Yeah, it's true.
And you, speaking of the sauce, you're a twin, and you do attribute that to sort of the left brain twin that you are, to sort of helping to carve your future as a chef and your future in this sort of chaotic creative food world.
I don't really know all that, but I mean, I do know that I have identical twin brother, and he's left-handed and I'm right-handed, which is called mirror twins, and which they say then he is right-brained and I'm left-brained, and being that way, I did things differently. I went on and got a degree in college and got into being a chef, but my brother was an artist, and he was a ceramicist and started a business as a potter, and then eventually got very involved in farming. So my brother is a farmer in Hawaii on the Big Island, and grows organic lettuce over there, and I'm a chef. So it's kind of an interesting how things kind of work out. I had no idea I was going to become a chef, but I don't think he thought he was going to be a farmer, I think we both found what we love to do and a passion for it, and we've been fortunate enough to be able to realize what we like to do.
Are mirror twins exceptionally, obviously it's unique, but is it a rarity?
Well, identical twins are, you know, a certain amount, but a mirror twin is even more so.
Yeah.
When a twin is a mirror twin, it means that you face each other in the womb.
Mm.
And so while you're developing the right brain and left brain are you're facing each other. Most twins come in the womb, they are back to front. But for some reason, the one of the embryos turns and you face each other. This is when, in the form of the embryo, can make it so that you can become Siamese twins. It's the next development from mirror twins.
Oh my gosh, quite a lesson. We're going to, no, seriously, that is absolute, that's fascinating stuff. It must have been cool. You have other siblings, so it must have been cool to have grown up in the shadow of the mirrors. We're going to take a break and play a super special song by Reparata and the Dalrons from the 1960s, and we're going to come back and talk all about the Brooklyn Girl now in Southern Cali.
We're running to a little storm, the cold's leaking. And if you haven't guessed, this is an SOS. If you still love them, answer yes.
This is Sarah, and I'm your host on Eat to the Beat, a radio program here on Heritage Radio Network. And we are sponsored by Roberta's Pizzeria. They physically house our studio and also are great supporters of what we do. Thanks, guys. Roberta'sPizzeria.com. You can check them out. Great pictures on the website. And again, great support for what we're doing on the network, the radio network. We're back with Gordon Smith and Reparata Mazzola. And that was Rep's sultry, the sultry sounds of Rep and the Delron. So you survived stardom.
We survived the 60s stardom. This is a whole different stardom.
No kidding.
That was a big hit in England, and the girls, and we did a tour over there, which was very exciting because, I mean, we were just in school, and to have a trip to Albany got canceled was a big deal. And when they told us we were going to London, we said, oh, can't we go to Italy? Because it's sunny over there. We had no idea that our record was number one on the charts over there.
Holy cow. And so you, speaking of Italy, you're Italian. You grew up in
Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, New York.
Flatbush.
Represent. And Flatbush. I didn't know that.
I went
great.
To Brooklyn College, too. For both my undergraduate and master's work, I went to Brooklyn College, three blocks from my house.
So how did you pull the Delrons together?
The Delrons and Reparata and the Delrons came together in high school and was discovered by Steve and Bill Jerome. And it was part of that whole era, you know, of the girl groups. And we were actually probably the last of the girl groups. We were, you know, we did all the good guy hops. It was a thing called WMCA at the time, and the Shangri-Las were big, mm-hmm. and, you know, it was the Redbird label, and it was very, very interesting.
How do you think you got on top? I mean, you had top 10 hits, you had number one hits for a couple weeks at a time. Do you think that, I mean, your music is fantastic, and it's so catchy, and it was seriously the best of its kind, but at the time, did you just have great promotion and exposure? Or?
Well, I have to say that was the era of, you know, like you see in the movies, kind of payola. We don't want to talk about that,
uh-huh.
but,
cool.
you know, if you... The records were good, don't get me wrong. We had great, but there was a way to promote a record in the 60s that doesn't exist anymore. And in fact, the whole music industry has changed so radically, I don't even know what would happen today. But we did a lot of promotion. We got a lot of radio play on the first one, so the second one was a hit. And then we got a lot of turntable play, but not a lot of hit records after that. I mean, people knew who we were, but we didn't get a lot of hit records. Mm-hmm. But we had a lot of great records. And we made it onto this Hatbox series of girl groups that's out right now.
Yeah.
And they happened to have picked two of my favorite songs. One was called I'm Nobody's Baby, and the other one's called I Can Hear the Rain. Those are my favorite ballads that we ever did. We had an awful lot of records. And that was also the era of the single before you had albums. So that's why we have a lot of records. We have only two albums, actually. One was Whenever a Teenager Cries, and the other one is called Reparata and the Delron Rock Revolution 1970, where we did a lot of remakes. And now there's two albums out, I understand, called they're called The Best of Reparata and the Delrons, which you can get.
So a lot of... we have an obsession with compilations, especially from back, you know, the Nuggets is a big compilations of 60 rocks music, you know, B-sides or sort of underground scratchy stuff. And so you're a dream come true for people who are putting out these records from that genre.
Yeah.
Just sort of flipping through your 45s.
I can't believe they found all the 45s
right.
and all the B-sides, too. These people really did a good job on this album.
Well, that has to so there's a similar story with Lady Flash. Lady Flash is the backup band for Barry Manilow, and you had so many personal favorites of his that really never made it out because of where they were placed, either on the record or which record it was, or maybe it wasn't, you know, didn't get enough oomph from, you know, the record company. Speak to how Lady Flash met Barry Manilow.
Well, Lady Flash was definitely an audition call, And I had known Barry because Barry knew of Rep Rod and the Delrons, of course, because he was from Brooklyn. And so he approached me about having the whole group back him up. I think he thought it would kind of be kind of campy because he used to work with Bette Midler, and Bette used to mention Rep Rod in his interact. So he thought that would be cool. But the other two girls didn't want to be involved. They didn't want to leave Brooklyn, I guess, and I was more ambitious. So the other two positions of Lady Flash were actually filled by Deborah Bird, who is now and has been since day one the American Idol vocal coach.
And that's a tidbit.
Yeah, she's been on American Idol since day one and done a lot of other backup. And then the other position was filled, you know, by a girl who left, and we had three girls actually fill that Lady Flash position until we ended up with our album, and we had Monica Page, who actually is still singing with Barry in Las Vegas.
And so, you guys, well, that's quite a legacy, yeah, for her. And you guys were on tour. I mean, you worked with Barry from what years?
I worked with him from 1974 till 1980, which was a very interesting era for Barry because it was really from the time when we were singing in clubs where we said, well, if there's more people on stage than there are on the audience, we won't go on for the second show.
How many people did you have on the stage? Typically?
Actually, we had seven. We had the three girls, Barry, and we had four musicians. So the first tour that Barry offered me was like 4 weeks, and we closed at Carnegie Hall. So I figured,
damn,
well, that's cool. And then it kept going. He had Mandy, and then, you know, we kept going. Then he had It's a Miracle, I Write the Songs. So we just kept working, you know, even though it goes to show you that you should never turn down a gig, because even if it's like a couple of days, it could go on forever.
Yeah, no kidding. You never know who, you know, even if there are three people in the audience.
Really? I mean, it was quite a ride because, you know, I saw Barry go from really, he was a big deal with Bette because he was Bette's music director. And then when he got his own band on the road, it was like the first class accommodations and the travel kind of went down the tubes when he was paying for it himself. And it was very interesting to see him launch into a superstar. By the time I left him, he was a bona fide superstar with a lot of hit records, like maybe 20.
And what was the road like with you guys? I mean, a lot of artists these days talk about, you know, they come out with their favorite lists of hotels and restaurants and yada yada. I mean, how did that work? How crazy did it get?
And how? In the beginning, it was really us with a U-Haul with our equipment going from place to place. To the end, when we had these big, you know, coliseums with our choice of food. I mean, the food on the road was interesting. It was started out with bologna sandwiches, and and then every promoter wanted to give us, you know, roast beef, mashed potatoes, and green beans, because that was considered a hot meal. Barry put in the contract that McDonald's was not considered hot or food, so they couldn't give us fast
food. Oh, it was ahead of his time.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, gradually we got to the point where Barry was a star, where he could demand, you know, a better food service. But, you know, the road is very grueling, and you're in one city and the next, and you don't see the bottom of your suitcase. It's a lot more glamorous from the outside than it is from in. But it was a great time and a great job, and I really love those days, and I love Barry to this day, you know.
We're going to play something by Lady Flash called Jumping at the Woodside.
Yeah.
Where the place is bad, you never heard of such a groovy hotel. Cop a room and then you fill your tent of it. I gotta go, I wanna go. Bangor, Maine, or
all the way to L.A. When I hit the woodside, I settle down and I'm there to stay. Never
mind. Hi, everyone. You're still listening to Eat to the Beat on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sarah, your host, and my guests are Gordon Smith and Reparata Mazzola. Hi, you guys still there?
Sure.
Yeah. Calling in from Southern California.
Yep, it's raining right now.
And it's raining. And Gordon is a huge, active food activist and a player in the food community down south, both in slow food and in the professional world of cooking food. And Reparata is a singer and now a writer and also runs a nonprofit, which we'll get to. But we want to go back to what Gordon, what you did just a little while ago with your career as a chef and how you got to be the personal chef for Betty Ford. What was the road that led up to that, and what was that like, and what were her needs, and what was the relationship like?
Well, I guess it all started back in kind of in the 80s when I went to college and was up in Sacramento, and I became a chef, basically a sous chef up in the Sacramento area while I was going to college. And from there, I went and worked for, I worked for Squaw Valley, was the ski resort, and then I was the chef for the 84 Olympics, and it was the one of the production managers. And then
Los Angeles hosted it in 84.
Yeah, we did it in Los Angeles, and I was one of the chefs that helped feed the athletes. Actually, I was the assistant manager to the chefs. And then went to Encinitas, and I think I was a chef at about 7 different restaurants, starting restaurants and running restaurants all over the Encinitas and North County area of Southern California, which is one of my favorite areas to live and work. And then from there I went up to L.A. and was the chef to Michael Eisner. I was his private chef for a while, and then there I did some more private work working for
what a cool time to be. I mean, you are in the thick. You're still in the thicket of it all, but you have literally been working your ass off for decades, and you must have seen, even though you were in the heartland of this bountiful California, just especially Southern California, produces so much wonderful food outdoors, that you have probably seen a transformation within the industry on the production side, what farmers, or even on that sort of the supply and demand side, how chefs and farmers communicate with each other has certainly evolved over the years. So do you want to speak to how, what you've noticed before we get to how you got to be Betty Ford's personal chef? Do you want to speak to how changed?
I think that California, one of the largest agricultural areas in the United States, and we have access to everything. I mean, from all the fruits and vegetables to sea, we have the ocean, we've got the cattle. I mean, everything is here in California, so we're very, very fortunate that almost all year round we have access to just about anything we want locally or in our area. But I have to say that throughout the history of the restaurants and all, a lot of it was just bought. They just bought from large brokers, and that food came from lots of different places. You never really knew where it came from, and I don't think the chefs were very aware of where their food came from until probably when Alice Waters, we all know Alice, started her work and brought in the idea of buying fresh and buying local.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when back in, I'd have to say, real early 70s is when I was introduced to Alice Waters, and that her first book, her whole idea of what I think about cooking and her philosophy is something that I embraced and that it became part of my reality.
And you brought that to your clients, something that they didn't necessarily know was so accessible, delicious, and so on.
Right, and the idea of organics and buying things that are not been sprayed and all that kind of thing was a concept that I've been involved with for a long, long time. I mean, I would think I've been around before even organic was a big term. It was, we were still trying to just buy food that wasn't sprayed. And then, you know, and I've had my own restaurant that was a completely organic restaurant and these kind of things in Encinitas. But it was really, I have to say, not maybe 20 years that we see a bigger change in the chefs in Southern California that have really taken on the idea of buying local and getting and sourcing their foods from farmers and small farmers and realize the cost we're going to have if we lose our small farmers. And so supporting them is not only are you getting a greater product, you're supporting a culture that if we lose, we'll never get back.
And you've taken that a step further and created a vertical garden kit for people at home. So you've allowed people at home. I mean, how is that project going?
I'll tell you, I'm working more on it on lots of different levels, but it's called VertiGrow. And if anybody wants to look it up on the internet, it's called VertiGrow. It's a way of growing up. It's you use these recycled styrofoam pots on a pole with a watering system that waters from a big bucket, and you can grow pretty much all your leafy vegetables and all your greens and lots of your strawberries and all that stuff.
This is indoors or outdoors?
Yeah, you can do it indoors or outdoors. I mean, we do it outdoors here. I've got one just right below my window here, and I get all my arugulas and all my greens, my lettuces, just by walking outside, and they're all in a kind of a, it's almost hydroponic, but it has a little bit more soil than that,
mm-hmm.
And it's just an interesting system, and it's going to grow. It's going to definitely become something really big.
So how do people find out more, and how, yeah, simply that.
Well, I'll give you the source. It's called VertiGrow, and you can buy their home systems or you can buy the systems that farmers are buying now. So they're not only, they're commercial and they're retail. So go to VertiGrow and check them out. This is a guy that started 40 years ago, and just in the last 2 years has just, as they say, blown up.
Mm. And We know. Hey, Rep, you still there?
Yeah.
What's the nonprofit you're working with, and what's the food aspect related to that? Because I know that's important.
Yeah, I work for a nonprofit called Right Girl. It was founded by Karen Taylor, who also used to live in New York. It's creative writing and mentoring for at-risk teens, and we have workshops for them in all genres and publish a book at the end of the year. Rightgirl.org is our website. But I get the food donated. And, well, I've found in the last couple of years, like last year it was a little getting more and more difficult to get food
because
donated.
Because they have a kitchen and they're feeding, the chicks have like a little like snack and they can hang out and have lunch or dinner. Or
No. We got full lunches donated for 140 women once a month from places like Panda Express. Panda Cares has a charitable arm. And
it's very hard to get donations because so many companies are so fearful of having of being sued by some, you know, by some sort of something that never happens. I know that I've wanted to get donations from supermarkets that are tossing bread, but they won't let us because,
you know, it's interesting. I've never really had that come up from any of the companies that have donated from us. We have big restaurant chains here who have donated, Pollo Loco but Panda Express is a Chinese chain. I don't know if you have it in New York, but they've been particularly generous, and I've never had that issue. It's interesting.
Well, I'm sure bringing the girls around the table and eating together and talking together and just having fun creates a wonderful environment in which to write and to get healthier and to get better.
Right. Well, we like to have them. We're looking actually now for healthy snacks. So if you know any snack companies that would like to donate, you know, like granola bars and things like that, that's what we're seeking right now because we need to get snacks for them.
I have a friend who's starting who's working with a caffeinated beef jerky company. What about that?
Oh, well, no, I don't think the girls would like that.
Guys, sadly, we need to wrap up, and I'm thinking of all the other things that we could have talked about, but we will bring you guys back on because you are movers and shakers, and you are on the front lines, and you both are wonderful, and you really bring Southern California, you know, you're great ambassadors of Southern California.
Thanks
for having us on, Gordon.
And thanks
Smith.
For the wild pigs.
And thanks for the wild pigs. You can talk about
that
another
story.
Time.
We'll okay. We'll see how we'll bring in some kind of a video cam to the radio show website and see how they're doing.
Yeah, and he's a mover and shaker in the food business. Heritage is fantastic.
Stories for another time. We're going to sign off with Barry himself.
Okay.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. From Boston to